If your business needs a new application, then developers will have to write code, a lot of code. If an application needs to be modernized, then you'll need time, resources, and caffeine. If that sounds daunting, then you need Watson X Code Assistant, AI designed to multiply developer productivity so you can generate code quickly. Let's create a more modern foundation for business with Watson X Code Assistant. Learn more at ibm.com/codeassistant. IBM, let's create.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
We are the voice of NASCAR.
The green flag is in the air, and we are underway. The Great American Race.
The Motor Racing Network. NASCAR Cup, Xfinity, and Craftsman Truck Series Racing. Live on your hometown radio station and MRN or NASCAR.com. Martinsville, Talladega, the Chicago Street Course. We have the side-by-side action and last lap passes for the win.
Photo finishes. Ryan Blaney will win.
The voice of NASCAR, the Motor Racing Network.
Hi, I'm Ethan Nadelman, and this is Psychoactive, a production of iHeartRadio and Protozoa Pictures. Psychoactive is the show where we talk about all things drugs. But any views expressed here do not represent those of iHeartMedia, Protozoa Pictures, or their executives and employees. Indeed, as an inveterate contrarian, I can tell you they may not even represent my own. And nothing contained in this show should be used as medical advice or encouragement to use any type of drugs. Hello, Psychoactive listeners. So my guest today is Dr. Dennis McKenna. He's the famed ethnobotanist, ethnopharmacologist, anthropologist who has been studying psychedelics and plant medicines for over 50 years. He's authored and co-authored dozens, if not hundreds, of articles and a number of books, both on his own and with others, including his famed brother, Terence McKenna. The impetus for doing this interview now is that a book that he wrote some years ago is about to be reissued. It's called The Brotherhood of the Screaming Abyss, and it's a memoir by Dennis that also includes a long account of his relationship with his brother and their respective journeys together and apart. So, Dennis, thank you ever so much for joining me and my listeners on Psychoactive.
Oh, thank you, Ethan, for inviting me. It's a pleasure. So thank you.
Well, just let me just start off. You know, in part of what I'm going to be talking about, right, is your brother Terence. And I realize on some level, it's got to be awfully irritating to have a famous brother and a famous brother in the same field, more or less, an intersecting field, yet who also, you know, because of the last names, obviously you've benefited from that familial connection. But obviously there was an intense personal relationship between that. But before we delve into the origins of that, which I really want to get into because you really get into it in the book, you know, when you first wrote this book, 2012, you know, I mean, you were fairly modest about, like, you know, when it all comes down to ultimately people pay more attention to me because, you know, my brother was Terence. But I wonder, over the last 10 years, which is when I've only known you over the last 10 years when we've crossed paths at various conferences, I mean, it seems to me that your name has become much more prominent as the psychedelics renaissance has kind of blasted off. And so I wonder if you were writing this memoir today, you know, how do you think it would be different in terms of your reflecting on your relationship with Terence and its impact on your life?
Well, not that different, actually. I mean, it will be different, and the difference will be reflected in this afterwards that I wrote. It's effectively another chapter, another about 50 to 60 page chapter, kind of looking back the last 10 years from the date that it was published, and even back the last 20 years mm-hmm. or so since Terence passed on, because the original book basically ends more or less when Terrence passed on in 2000, mm-hmm. you know, and you mentioned that, you know, it must be irritating to, you know, be the brother of Terrence McKenna because he gets all the attention, you know, and in a way that's still true. I mean, Terrence has probably got more Twitter followers than I do. Not bad for a guy who's been dead for 22 years, you know, but I don't really resent it at all because Terrence and I were, you know, we were intensely interested in the same things, but different complementary aspects of the same thing. So we didn't mm-hmm. really have any kind of rivalry. We were competing for attention. And I mean, what fame we had was basically from our books. And in Terrence's case, he was very much on the lecture circuit.
Mm-hmm.
And I was not so much. And that was really by choice. You know, I preferred to be in the background. I'm inherently, you know, by nature, I'm kind of an introvert and I like to be in the background.
You know, one of the things that's interesting is you really, part of the thing about your book, the Brotherhood book of the Screaming Abyss, is you're kind of like reflecting and psychoanalyzing about your life and your family and mm-hmm. your parents and Terrence. And, you know, obviously, you know, he's 4 years older. He's born in 46. You're born in 1950. But you describe at a young age about him basically being a fairly torturous older brother. I mean, you know, tickling you, scaring the hell out of you. What he says, what is the thing? Never oppose my will, he says to you, and he freaks you out about the nobody people. And look, I'm the oldest of four, so I'm probably guilty of some of the stuff that Terrence was guilty of, but I don't think I was quite as mean as he was back then.
Well, I think that the way, you know, the dynamic was between us back then is not that atypical from little brother to older brother, you know, kind of interactions and dynamics, especially when the gap in age is 4 years. I mean, that's a kind of a critical gap because that means, you know, as we moved into education, like when I was in junior high school, he was in high school. When I was in high school, he'd already left. But I describe those things, you know, you write a memoir and you write about what you remember. And mm-hmm. in my early time growing up, that's what I remember, you know, when, mm-hmm. when Terrence and I were together. I also remember a lot of good times, mm-hmm. you know, we had great times. He was, you know, he was the big brother. He was, you know, my parents' favorite for years, at least I was convinced so. And they went out of their way to make sure he had anything he wanted in terms of, you know, educational opportunities, support, you know, for his hobbies and so on. I mean, later I got those things, but I was happy to tag along.
But Dennis, look, if I dig a little bit here, it's because obviously all of this you say in the book and the love between the two of you and his profound influence both on you and more broadly just comes through clearly. But I mean, you say in the book, and other people point this out, that it's not just Terrence, but it's the two of you who might be described as the Johnny Appleseeds of psilocybin. I mean, yeah. You guys, when you come back from the Amazon in the 70s and you produce this book, The Magic Mushroom Grower's Guide, I think in mm-hmm. 1976, which is really kind of the first how-to guide to how to, you know, use mushroom spores to grow, make your own marijuana at home in a very simple way. And thereby essentially, I mean, I think you say that might be the most important thing that either of the two of you ever did. But just tell us a little bit about that book, which the two of you, and I guess with another fellow, Jeremy Bigwood, played a role as well. But tell us how that book came about and why and its impact.
Yeah, I can do that. So some people even recently have said, you know, have been at pains to point out that we weren't the first ones to do that, you know, and I never really claimed that we were. People were experimenting. They were trying to figure it out. I think what was different was that we were the first to publish a book that was a simple method that got into many people's hands. And that was the social impact of it. Not that other people weren't doing it at the time. Other people were not publishing books about it or even talking about it. And because it was illegal, it took a certain amount of either foolishness or courage or both to publish that book, and we did, and it had an impact. But I was not taught how to do this. I puzzled it out. I was taking courses at Colorado State University. I had been out to Harvard to see Schultes. I wanted to work with Schultes. This was 1974. And Schultes told me after I did my pilgrimage, he said, you know, go back and take more chemistry and take more taxonomy, because I thought I was going to study higher plants, you know. Well, as it turned out, a friend of mine was the head of the botany greenhouse at CSU when I went back to CSU to take these additional courses. Even though I'd already got my degree, I took these additional courses, organic chemistry course, which turned out to be a revelation, because the teacher of that course was an incredible mentor. Anyway, I had access to this laboratory, this tissue culture laboratory. So I had all the tools to mess around, and I had the spores, and then this paper in Mycologia surfaced, which was called by James P. San Antonio. It was a USD researcher that was something like, you know, a simple method to grow Agaricus bisporus on substrates of sterilized rye, you know. And basically, I tried that with the mushrooms, and it worked. You know, so that was the breakthrough. It just worked for this other species. So then once we had that technique, you know, figured out it reliably worked, I shared that with Terrence. I shortly after that finished my work at CSU, and I moved to California, and we actually set up growing operations there, and then published the book. And at some point, Terrence had already connected with Jeremy Bigwood. I'm not sure how he made that connection, but I think it was through Jonathan Ott. And Jeremy was part of that whole coterie of psychedelic enthusiasts at Evergreen State College, out of which Paul Stamets came, but then also Jeremy. And Jeremy, so that was the connection. And Terrence had met Jeremy in Berkeley at some point and invited him to be the photographer on the book, to photograph the methods. And then Terrence's girlfriend, and then later his wife, Kat Harrison, was the illustrator, producing these beautiful line drawings of the mushrooms, the life cycle, and all that. So that, those were the four people that generated the book. Terrence and myself, Jeremy with the photographs, and Kat as the artist.
But you published it under pseudonyms, right?
Well, yes, all pseudonyms. And I thought it was ironic that, you know, in some ways, Jeremy chose the pseudonym Irimaeus the Obscure. And I used to kid him. I said, is that a reflection of the terrible photographs that you put in the book? Because they weren't really that good. They did do the job, but then you know, they weren't that great. They were little and sort of muddy and so on, but they did show how to do it.
Yeah.
But he made up for it with the beautiful color photographs and the color insert for the first edition, you know.
Right.
And those were great. I was really disappointed when they republished it under a different company, and they dropped those color photographs.
Well, Desleas, you mentioned you and Terrence starting to grow mushrooms as well. So were you making, I mean, I imagine the statute of limitations has got to expire by now. Were you making a lot of money selling mushrooms in those days?
Well, we were making money, you know. I wouldn't say a lot, but we were probably making enough that we didn't have to, you know, have actual jobs in a certain way. And that's something that Terrence continued for many years. But he decided, you know, maybe that's too edgy. Maybe he didn't really want to do that. As his fame grew, he decided it was a good idea to step back from that.
I mean, you also talk about Terrence's, you know, time as, you know, sort of, you know, sending hashish or cannabis around the world and having to be on the run as a fugitive for a few years. But going back to the book again, and your youth and the influences, you talk about, I mean, you also talk about growing up as Catholics. And
yes.
How, you know, until a certain age, you're a good Catholic boy, but you also have an encounter with a Catholic priest who does what, you know, many Catholic priests have become infamous
for. What Catholic priests
do
all yeah, too so often.
just tell our listeners a little bit about your Catholic childhood and your encounter, to which you seem to respond to feeling like it wasn't all that traumatic.
My encounter with the priest was not all that traumatic because I was so clueless. Uh-huh. Basically, I was, I think, about 8 years old, maybe a little older than that. But I didn't realize I was being abused, you know. I mean, I live close to the rectory. I used to go over and hang out with the priests. There were other priests there, usually. And there were some of them were pretty cool, you know. I mean, they were like Jesuits, mm-hmm. and they had, you know, they were intellectuals. Father, I won't say his name. I think I call him Father Dan in the book, but,
yeah.
but he was not like that. But he was also, he was interesting. He'd been an engineer before he'd been a priest, and, you know, and he liked the altar boys. And now I have a better idea just why he liked the altar boys. I don't know how many of them he actually molested, but you know, the way it happened with us is I confided in him that, you know, I was ticklish, and I was very ticklish, still am ticklish, you know, and I confided this in him, and he said, well, I can help you get over that. And so, you know, we went into the basement, and I disrobed at least mostly, and he kind of touched me all over. He didn't penetrate me. There was nothing like that. It was just, you know, it was kind of a weird massage, you know. And mm-hmm. again, I'm working under the assumption that he's helping me get over being ticklish. So I was not alarmed, you know, at all, or didn't really think in terms of abuse and so on. What was going on in his head, I don't know. I suppose he was getting a charge out of it. But, you know, it took me, like, I didn't even think about it for years, you know. And then suddenly one day it dawned on me, man, I was being abused, you know. But at the time, I was not traumatized.
And Dennis, in all of your thousands of psychedelic experience with different types of mushrooms and ayahuasca and DMT and everything else, I mean, have there been times when processing either, you know, Terrence's tormenting and torturing you, or this experience with the priest, or other traumatic things of childhood kind of came up and got processed for you? Or was that never really, because I don't come across references, when I was reading the book, to that sort of processing of these kind of early things?
Yeah, they haven't come up, you know, in my psychedelic experiences, probably because apart from that, you know, and apart from Terrence's abuse and torture, but I didn't really experience those things as trauma. I may have been traumatized by other factors, but I don't look back on it and think, you know, I'm screwed up because of mm-hmm. childhood traumas. Actually, my childhood, I would say our childhood, was remarkably normal and free of that kind of thing. I mean, I think there's always dysfunctionalities in families, but in general, I mean, my father and mother were not abusive, you know, and they were very loving and supportive. Mm-hmm. At the same time, Terrence and I, you know, pushed back against them, Terrence particularly, on all kinds of fronts. I mean, I'm sure that we, you know, made their lives miserable in many ways, you know.
I mean, you describe Terrence at one point, like, at one point you say, you know, in some respects he was unforgiving, you know, once he decided, you know, he had written you off, that was it, and not all that empathetic. And you also describe at a very young age him cutting off your father, like, emotionally.
Yep.
In a way that never really recovered, I guess.
Never really recovered. Never really got over that. That's right. That's
and at the age of four, I mean, this is not a teenage thing. This is at the age of four or five or something, right?
Right, right, exactly. There was an incident, which I'd rather not describe in graphic detail, but, but you know, it led to an estrangement on some emotional level between him and my dad. And I think at a certain point, he crossed the threshold there where he came to the conclusion that, you know, I've got to look out for myself, or I am, you know, I have to be number one. I mean, kind of a, well, I wouldn't say a Trumpian kind of thing, but a preoccupation with his own self-preservation and all that, you know.
Well, I mean, you describe also, you know, Ayn Rand as something of a, you know, one of the influences on Terrence when he's growing up.
Yeah, Ayn Rand was one of the books that he was reading as he was growing up, and everybody. I mean, at that age, you know, 18, 16, 17, 18, in that era, the late 60s, everybody was reading Ayn Rand, you know, and getting the, you know, the download that, that she transmitted. You know, the other popular book was Catcher in the Rye, you know, and everybody was, I wasn't reading them because I was 4 years younger and they were not really part of my universe, but I think Ayn Rand and the, or Ayn Rand as they call her, and Catcher in the Rye were influential books for people of Terrence's generation when they were teenagers in the, you know, in the late, even mid 60s. So he was about 4 years ahead. So all of these things were coming down.
Right.
I don't know how much it influenced him. I mean, Ayn Rand is identified with the right now and so on. I think, you know, I think there's a wider perception that her philosophy is, you know, pretty distasteful in some ways, not compassionate, you know, sort of very typical of some of the, you know, right wing ideologies that people are, you know, it's everyone for themselves, you know,
right.
There's a great lack of compassion and empathy in this perspective. Well, I don't agree with that. You know, I think that we have to, I mean, I think if psychedelics teach you anything, it is that we are all connected. We're all one. We're all in the same boat. And I think, you know, they're useful for eliciting compassion and empathy. And I think we need more of that, not less of that. I mean, not only for each other, but for nature itself. But as I get older, I get more sort of maybe disillusioned, you could say, a little more cynical about it. I think they have great potential for societal evolution and transformation, but the question is it happening fast enough? And you know, because we are looking, as I say in the book, in the afterwards, you know, we're looking at a closing window here where we have to make decisions and our choices are becoming more and more restricted. So can psychedelics turn this around? I think they're part of the process. I don't think psychedelics alone are gonna do it.
We'll be talking more after we hear this ad.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
You know, Dennis, I mean, one of the things that when I've seen you speak and written some of your writing, I sometimes, you know, on the one hand, you're very much the scientist and you very much fit within that, you know, the all the other growing the scientists in this world of the psychedelic renaissance. But you're also this kind of bridge to the ways of thinking that Terence epitomized. Mm-hmm. And so in the book, you talk about the influences on both of you growing up. And some of them were common influences. Like you talk, for example, about your fascination with cosmology and astronomy. And then especially, you talk a lot about science fiction and how mm-hmm. that shaped really your thinking. And you can sort of see that manifesting, not just in, you know, some of the stuff, some of Terence's recordings, but even in your own speaking. And obviously Stanley Kubrick's 2001, you come back to that movie frequently. There's another movie called Charlie you come back to. Mm-hmm. So just talk more about, you know, the impact of science fiction and cosmology in those movies in both your thinking and to some extent your brother's as well.
Well, science fiction was a huge influence on us, you know, and I think we can attribute that to a certain extent, in fact, to a large extent, to our father, who also read science fiction. And he, when he was a child, he had had rheumatic fever. So he'd spent quite a lot of time in bed as a child. He couldn't go to school. What did he do? He read. He read all kinds of things. He read a lot of Westerns and things like that, but he also read what science fiction there was of those days, you know. There wasn't, I mean, not like we think of it, but it was like fantasy, Tom Swift's adventures and this kind of thing. And so when he had a family and all that, he spent a lot of time. His job required him to be on the road 5 days a week. He was a traveling sales representative for a company in Denver. So he would be gone from Monday through Friday. And he would need things to read on the road. So he would buy these pulp science fiction magazines that you could buy off the shelf. He would also buy Fate magazine. And he'd bring these things home. And Fate magazine is a very interesting magazine. It's still published. And it was the sort of popular magazine about the esoteric and the strange, you know, so all about aliens and paranormal phenomena and UFOs and occasionally drugs. You know, there were articles about mescaline and ayahuasca and things like that. You're talking, you know, the 60s, the 50s and 60s. But he would bring Fate magazine and these science fiction, pulp magazines like Asimov Science Fiction or Fantasy and Science Fiction, or these different ones that you could buy. And Terence and I were all over those, you know, and particularly Fate magazine. I mean, he would bring these Fate magazines home and we would be all over it. So I think in Terrence and Me, it cultivated a fascination with the esoteric and the strange. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, from our perspective, you know, we were weird, and the weirder the better. You know, and so when psychedelics came along, I think that we viewed it not from a context of spirituality or indigenous practices or anything like that. I mean, we discovered that later, but originally the idea was that, hey, these are other dimensions. Psychedelics can take you to other dimensions, and we thought of that quite literally, you know, that these were tools for actually visiting other realms, you know, hyperspatial dimensions. That was the approach. And that perspective really colored our whole experiment at La Chorrera.
So I'll just say quickly, you know, La Chorrera is the place in the Colombian Amazon where Dennis and Terrence in around 1971 go
right.
for a number of weeks and have a really formative experience. They go there looking for a particular, you know, a psychedelic and land up finding out that maybe mushrooms is the one that they were really needing to learn to, you know, understand better, and where Dennis describes basically having, whether it was a psychotic break or a spiritual breakthrough or a communication with aliens, but going what might be seen as largely crazy for a while and a bit unhinged, and his brother worrying he might not even come back. But it's Dennis describes almost the pinnacle of their relationship, even though it's a very traumatic time. Did I sum that up fairly?
Yeah, I think so. Without going into too much detail, I think that was exactly it. You know, I've done various talks on the experiment at La Chorrera, but Breaking Convention conference a few years ago, I did a talk called The Experiment at La Chorrera, Psychotic Break, Shamanic Initiation, or Alien Encounter? ? And it looked at these different modalities that could be applied to the experiment at La Chorrera. And I was kind of arguing for the idea that, yeah, there were elements of an alien encounter in this thing, along with the shamanic elements, the psychotic elements, and so on. And, you know, Eric Davis, who writes very eloquently about this, he, in his book High Weirdness, there's a whole chapter about Terrence and Dennis and our adventures at La Chorrera. And he makes the, I think, really insightful point in a way that we went to La Chorrera thinking that we were doing an act of science, you know, which we weren't. What we were doing is we committed an act of science fiction. I think that's very apt. I think that's exactly what we were doing, because, you know, given our limited grasp of science, we were not scientists. We thought we were, we fancied we were, but we weren't. But given our limited grasp of scientific understandings and so on, you know, we were trying to bring all these kind of more or less, you know, unrefined, unsophisticated scientific concepts to what we were doing, to the idea that, you know, we could actually crack the space-time continuum, you know, and step through into this new atemporal realm. So that goes right back to the 60s, you know, fascination with other dimensions and all that, and the idea that that psychedelics could be portals to this. We're not alone now. Lots of people are talking about this very same thing. You know, I recently attended a private conference in the UK in October, which the theme of the conference was the sentient other, and it was all about DMT entities and the other kinds of entities that you encounter in psychedelic experiences, you know. And the problem with DMT, it's too short, you know. By the time you get there, to this place or this dimension or this state, it's already fading away. It's very hard to spend enough time there to really get a handle on what's going on. So you come back with, you know, a sense of astonishment, but not much actual data. It's such a short-acting experience when you smoke it.
Dennis, just to clarify for our listeners, I mean, DMT is one of the essential ingredients in ayahuasca, but right. It's also something that can be smoked for a, you know, shorter experience, right? And then you have, I guess, one of the early books that kind of, you go back to the early origins, the early 21st century origins, the psychedelic renaissance. Some of that goes back to Rick Straussman and his research and book, yes. DMT, the Spirit Molecule. And here we're distinguishing that from 5-MeO-DMT, which also people smoke for a short, intense experience.
Right.
But they're fundamentally different.
These are the two. Huh? These are the two. Two tryptamines that are short acting. They're not orally active unless you potentiate them with a monoamine oxidase inhibitor, right? And that's the basis mm-hmm. of ayahuasca. The two plants, one of them contains an MAO inhibitor, which inhibits the DMT from breakdown in the gut. And then it's orally active, and instead of 15, 20 minutes, you have 6 to 7 hours. But much less intense than the 15 to 20 minutes. The other way people take it is, so the term is parenterally, either inject it or usually people smoke the free base, and then you get this very intense 15 to 20 minute, I sometimes refer to it as like a trip on a neon roller coaster. I mean, there mm-hmm. is definitely a very visual space, you know, and all sorts of things going on, really like being in a different place. 5-methoxy is actually not like that. 5-methoxy is different in that it lacks the visual dimension for some reason.
5-methoxy is the same as is the same thing as 5-MeO-DMT.
Yes, 5-MeO-DMT, 5-methoxy, people call it. It is, you get effectively the same feeling of dissolution, being in this space, so this feeling of acceleration, but there's no visuals, you know. And the things that set DMT apart is it's all about visuals, you know, including the apparent encounter with other intelligences. Mm-hmm. DMT, I mean, I have much more experience with DMT than 5-methoxy-DMT, but my experience with 5-methoxy is that it is the total ego and really self-dissolution drug. I mean, what it does is, for me at least, it just dissolves the self. It dissolves the ego. It's like, you know, the cliche with the psychedelics is we are all one. You know, and we merge with everything. And 5-methoxy delivers that experience when you really have very little or almost no sense of the self as a discrete entity. You're just part of the continuum, you know. Mm-hmm. DMT is not that way. It's not the ego-dissolving kind of approach. It's, I mean, you're still you. I mean, your ego may be, you know, the boundaries may be getting a little shaky, but you're still yourself, and very often in relationship, in this, you know, relationship with these extra-dimensional entities, which are presenting as intelligences, and, you know, maybe so. I mean, I'm skeptical. You know, the main question here, if you have these encounters with these apparent non-human but obviously intelligent entities, the first question is, are they real? Mm-hmm. You know? And then, but then that's a loaded question, because then you have to say, well, what do you mean by real? You mm-hmm. know? And right. this is where I get, you know, I mean, people look at me and say, well, you just can't accept it. And I'm saying, it's not that I don't accept it. I'm trying to figure out, is this coming from some part of the self, some part of myself that is presenting as something that is not me, or is it really something from elsewhere that is in communication? You know,
well, you know, I mean, it's interesting because you describe in the book, you know, that you and Terence returning from La Chirea, you know, 50 years ago, 52 years ago or so. And you know, Terence comes back and says, basically, science can't explain any of this stuff. Essentially, let's skip it. And you come back saying, well, we can't dismiss science unless we understand science better. And it seems like that's a key place where your trajectories really go off in different directions. That's where you decide to go and get the degrees and become a scientist. And it seems, I mean, I'm more sympathetic to your viewpoint, which is if we want to try to figure out whether there is something about aliens communicating with us through mushrooms or these things being exported to Earth from in that way, or how we think about different manifestations of reality, we better know the science a lot better so we can critically evaluate both its, you know, what it has to say as well as its limitations.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you put your finger right on it. That at that point, you know, after our return from psychedelics represented a point where our trajectories in some ways diverged, you know, and Terence, yes, said, well, science is never going to explain this. We should just throw science out. My response is, we can't say that because we're not scientists and we don't really understand how to do science. You know, so if we're going to reject science, let's learn how to do it first. Then we can examine these phenomena in the light of sort of the scientific perspective, scientific framework, and decide, you know, or help us decide what is going on, or give it up and say, yeah, science can't explain this. In trying to understand nature, I think science is a good place to start, you know, because science, unlike most endeavors of human thought, it's a way to construct models about the way things are, the way you think things are, and then test the model, you know, test it against what the evidence is, and either reject the model or modify it or whatever. In this way, scientific knowledge advances. This is the scientific method. And it's not often practiced the way it should be, but in its pure form, this is what science is. And it's a very powerful way of thinking.
You describe in the book having a very powerful ayahuasca experience, I think in the context of the UDV church in Brazil. And the single sentence that you most come away with is this one: you monkeys only think you're running things.
Yes.
Now, how does that fit into what you were just talking about science?
I think that psychedelics are a great counterbalance to science. I think one of the pitfalls of science and scientists particularly is a tendency to think that, you know, we have made such advances, we have such sophisticated understanding of the cosmos and the way things are, we pretty much have this thing figured out, you know, and I think psychedelics emphatically illustrate to us we only have a tiny part of reality figured out. You know, there's no excuse for arrogance here. What we should be humble, because we should always bear in mind how little we really know, what a small part of the total picture science furnishes us for us. And scientists tend to be arrogant, you know, there's no room for arrogance. They should be more humble. They should recognize, no matter how much science advances, how much we expand our understanding, it's still only going to be a tiny slice of the total picture. And psychedelics are useful for that, making that realization. And that's effectively what I meant by you monkeys only think you're running the show. We are not in control. You know, I'm not sure anyone is in control, but right. we're participating in this, this co-evolutionary process with the plants, with everything on the planet, and we're not running the show at all.
Let's take a break here and go to an ad.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, Healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that Healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
Well, you know, I sometimes think in the book, I think one other indication of the kind of, I shouldn't say two sides as if they're oppositional, but the two aspects, Dennis, to your way of thinking about this is, you know, you talk about, you know, in the 50s, really Gordon Wasson and his wife's writings in Life magazine and their encounter with Maria Sabina and the book about mushrooms in Russia really kind of launches the first stage of really popular awareness about psychedelics. And then in the 60s. I mean, you're a bit dismissive of Timothy Leary. I mean, I think you're more critical of him than not. And in some respects, you know, later on, you worry, oh my God, I don't want my brother, you know, Terrence to become like the new Timothy Leary and do the kind of harms that are oftentimes associated with Timothy Leary's kind of going over the top. But what you do credit are two books, which both of which come out, I think, in the late 60s or early 70s. One is Carlos Castaneda's The Teachings of Don Juan, which, you know, probably sold billions of copies. I remember I had a copy when I was younger as well, which is, you know, probably largely fictional, but you say nonetheless very important. And the other book, though, somewhat surprisingly quote, is a volume that's published by the National Institute of Mental Health, you know, a U.S., you know, health agency, the proceedings of a conference held in San Francisco in 1967. So explain why those two books actually play an important role in your evolution.
They were very influential for me personally, those two books. The Castaneda book, which Terrence gave to me for my 18th birthday, and yes, it probably is largely fictional, but I didn't know that at the time, and it doesn't really matter, because what it presented was the ethnographic side, the indigenous origins of these things, the idea that there were, you know, indigenous worldviews and understandings about these substances and these plants and fungi. So that was like the cosmovision of you know, the indigenous world. And then on the other hand, the ethnopharmacologic search for psychoactive drugs, the name of this conference in 67, which was a private conference, the only thing that the taxpayers ever got was the publication, the book itself, which was published, and somehow or other it fell into my hands again at the age of 18, the year after the conference. And this actually happened some years before my understandings about science and the whole conversation about rejecting science and so on. That book really opened up for me that ethnopharmacology was a real discipline. There is actual science here. There were people working in this, people like you know, icons, still icons like Schultes and Shulgin, and even Andy Weil was at that conference. So it was an eye-opener for me in the sense that there's a real discipline here, and potentially a discipline that, you know, I could follow as a career path. And that was kind of what led me to that direction, to start studying not only ethnography, which I was also interested in, but botany and chemistry and pharmacology, mm-hmm. and all that. It was the inspiration. That book was the inspiration for that. Mm-hmm.
You know, Dennis, I'll tell you, there's another thing that pops up in your writing. You keep coming back to, more than most people I know write about psychedelics, and it's the dark side. I mean, you write about the brujas, the witches, both in Europe and Latin America, and the uses of datura. And you tell the story of a leading and quite powerful ayahuasquero, Pablo Amaringo, who basically, you know, stops leading sessions because he's gotten involved in some sort of, you know, conflict with what he sees are brujas, which could potentially be a conflict to the death by where either kill or be killed. So say something about that dark side of this.
Yeah, well, there is a dark side. I mean, psychedelics are a tool, you know, like any other technology, they're a tool, and they can be used or misused, you know, and because they can put people into very vulnerable states, that's kind of the point of these intense psychedelic therapy sessions, is to provide circumstances where you can open up. You know, you can look at your problems, whether they be addiction or depression or, you know, whatever your issues are, from a different perspective. I think that's really the most important therapeutic aspect of psychedelic therapy, is they let you step away from your reference frame temporarily, what we now call the default mode network, although there are other terms for it as well. And in traditional cultures, like in South America, for example, not all the ayahuasqueros are good people. You know, I mean, there is a power dynamic there. And if you have a drug or something that will let you get power over people, there are many curanderos that are effectively sorcerers. They want power. They want money, sex. They want all of these things that, you know, people yearn to have, and if they can be used to, you know, to effectively render, you know, people compliant and willing to give up their selfhood, then they will employ them that way. I think most of the people, traditional practitioners using ayahuasca, really do it from the standpoint of being healers and helping people. Like Pablo Amaringo, you know, was a good example of that. Like many of the ayahuasqueros that I was lucky enough to work with, I had no idea. I mean, I learned this over time, that not all of these people can be trusted. And we see this now, you know, there's a great deal of maybe overstated on the other side. There's a great deal of paranoia for people that are doing, want to go to South America and do ayahuasca retreats and so on. Like, you know, people say, well, you must be very careful, you know, not to get in with the wrong people, because, you know, they'll damage you in many, many ways. And that's true. I think it's a matter of proceeding thoughtfully and sort of not, just don't sign up for a retreat at the first website that comes up, you know. Do your research, ask around, talk to people that know the ropes down there, and, take care to get to the right places.
Well, you've talked about sometimes the ayahuasca actually being mixed with a little bit of datura or something, or,
That does happen. When the ayahuasca is mixed with datura, sometimes they put it in because they actually make bad ayahuasca, and if they add in the datura, that ensures that something will happen, you know, not necessarily what you want to happen, but
right.
that pretty much will make it active. And other times they put in Datura because their, you know, their motives are more sinister. I mean, Datura is a, Brickmansia as it's called, the tree Daturas in South America, but the Daturas in European, you know, European witchcraft and all that. These are deliriants, and these are, they're not psychedelics. They're deliriants. They're drugs that create a great deal of confusion. And they also wipe your memory out and, to a certain degree. And they also make you very suggestible, you know. So classic example of like a date rape drug, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And actually in Colombia, it's used that way. You know, if you take ayahuasca and there's Datura in it, there's Brugmansia been added into it. The traditional term for it is Toé. They call it Toé. You can tell if your ayahuasca has been dosed with Datura because you get this classical dry mouth reaction. Those tropanes make you feel very thirsty, and they, of course, dilate the eyes greatly, and so they produce blurred vision and all that. If you're getting those symptoms, that probably means there's a good swack of Toé in the brew, and for me, that's a red flag, you know, to get the hell out of there, because this person does not have your best interests at heart.
You know, in a way, I mean, you've been identified so much with ayahuasca, but also, of course, mushrooms, and not just the growing guide. But and it's interesting the way you talk about them, right? At one point, you say, are they alien artifacts? And you've mentioned this already. Then another time, you say, well, mushrooms can be tricksters. And someplace else, you say bullshitters at times. And they have a way
yes.
of presenting delusions as self-evident truths. And then someplace else you go, they are mushrooms, the perfect psychedelic exclamation point.
Well, they are the perfect psychedelic, you
Why?
Know, I mean, in the sense that they're, you know, they're non-toxic, they're generally non-threatening, they're usually enjoyable, and they do download information, you know, but like all psychedelics do. But I think it's up to the individual to, you know, not necessarily lower your analytical antennas. You know, you get revelations, you get insights from psychedelics, and they seem, maybe at the time, they seem like true revelations, but you know, you need to look at it the next day in the cold hard light of reality mm-hmm. and see if that really stands up, you know,
mm-hmm.
and that's what I mean by they can be tricksters. That ayahuasca can be a trickster, although I think it's less common. But you have to keep your powder dry in a certain sense, and not necessarily just take in everything that the mushrooms tell you. Or the danger is you're gonna get into some delusionary state that's very hard to get out of, you
mm-hmm.
know, if you just accept this. I mean, I get emails kind of dismayingly frequently from people, you know, that have had these really powerful experiences, and they've come away and they say, oh yes, you know, I am the Messiah. I am
right.
the transcendental object at the end of time. I figured all this out. And, you know, wait a minute, cowboy, calm down, think about it and get
yeah,
back to
yeah.
me, you know, or hopefully don't get back to me because I don't have time for this shit. But
right.
anyway, you
well,
know.
Dennis, let me ask you this, you know, I mean, obviously some of the stuff that Terrence was coming up with, you know, like the world ending in 2012 and a whole lot of stuff just seems off the wall in retrospect. But there's at least one thing that not just he, but you also have talked about with frequency that's maybe looking a little better over the years, and that's the stoned ape theory.
Yes.
Yeah. So just explain to our listeners what that is and why it's looking better.
Well, the stoned ape theory, it's kind of a pejorative way to describe it, but the idea basically that we co-evolved with mushrooms, that you know, the hominid species evolved in Africa, you know, 2 to 3 million years ago. And they evolved, leading eventually to, you know, there were different species, starting with Homo habilis and then, you know, Homo erectus, Homo Neanderthal, eventually Homo sapiens, although it wasn't quite as linear as that implies. But what we know is now, it's a very hard theory to prove, but what we do know is that hominid lineages were evolving in northern and actually southern Africa as well during this period. We know that the climate for about 2 million years ago was much wetter. There were seasonal rainfalls. It was not a dry desert like it is now. And, you know, we've got the paleoclimatological data to support that. We know that there were cows, or the precursors of modern cows, both, I forget the species, but there were cow species. The fossils of these cows have been found. They evolved in the same environment that the hominids did. Undoubtedly, the hominids hunted them and ate them. Well, the mushrooms grow on the dung of these cows. And if you look at any tropical ecosystem, you know, where there's rainfall, pastures, and, you know, grazing cattle, you're going to find these mushrooms, in, you know, Psilocybe cubensis, in most places. The thing that makes it more plausible now is, so probably in that environment, obviously, the primates were there, and they had to be eating the mushrooms if the mushrooms were there. After all, they're hungry, you know, and the mushrooms are good to eat, and they're not hard to spot. The two things that make it more plausible now is what we've learned about the effects that psilocybin have on neural connectivity and the, you know, neurogenesis, and basically the complexification of the brain, you know, could have been triggered by these mushrooms, because this is what they do. And, you know, we have the data to support that now. So potentially it could have been a cognitive boost for the populations that were eating these mushrooms, leading to language formation and the formation of the brain structures that support cognition, internalization of imagery, you know, synesthesia, all of these kinds of things. And then the other side of this coin is, well, okay, maybe so. What's the heritable mechanism? How is this transmitted from generation to generation? Well, now we can invoke epigenetics, which was not a concept that was talked about when Terence published his book in 1993. Neither that nor this neuroplasticity element. We now know that, you know, mushrooms foster neuroplasticity, which has to do with adaptation to external stimuli as well as internal. And then epigenetics provides a mechanism whereby these traits can be transmitted across generations. So, I mean, you can't ever prove this idea, but I think these two notions move the needle from plausible to more than likely, if you want to put it that way. Mm-hmm. And I think it's more than likely that mushrooms did play a role in this evolutionary period, where we saw an expansion in the size and complexity of the human brain over a mere 2 million years. Well, 2 million years sounds like a long time, but evolutionarily, it's actually the blink of an eye. So how did this exponential expansion in human neural complexity take place? I submit that mushrooms were the catalyst for this.
Well, Dennis, on that fascinating note, I want to thank you for joining me and my listeners on Psychoactive for discussion about your book and your brother and your work. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks so much, Ethan. It's been a pleasure.
If you're enjoying Psychoactive, please tell your friends about it. Or you can write us a review at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. We love to hear from our listeners. If you'd like to share your own stories, comments, and ideas, then leave us a message at 1-833-779-2460. That's 833-PSYCHO-0. Or you can email us at psychoactive@protozoa.com or find me on Twitter at Ethan Nadelman. You can also find contact information in our show notes. Psychoactive is a production of iHeartRadio and Protozoa Pictures. It's hosted by me, Ethan Nadelman. It's produced by Noam Osband and Josh Thane. The executive producers are Dylan Golden, Ari Handel, Elizabeth Giesis, and Darren Aronofsky from Protozoa Pictures, Alex Williams and Matt Frederick from iHeartRadio, and me, Ethan Nadelman. Our music is by Ari Belusian, and a special thanks to Avivit Bar-Yosef, Bianca Grimshaw, and Robert Beebe. Next week, we'll be talking about the global history of drugs with Professor Paul Gutenberg of SUNY Stony Brook, perhaps the leading expert in this area.
Drugs were actually quite important in the constitution of modernity as we think of it today. Starting in the 16th century, all types of stimulants began to flow together and reach first Europeans and then Middle Easterners and Asians and North Americans, and they began to be part of our kind of integral lifestyles. Everything from coffee to tobacco, and then later things like, you know, Coca-Cola or opiates.
Subscribe to Psychoactive now so you don't miss it.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
We are the voice of NASCAR.
The green flag is in the air, and we are underway. The Great American Race.
The Motor Racing Network. NASCAR Cup, Xfinity, and Craftsman Truck Series Racing. Live on your hometown radio station and MRN or NASCAR.com. Martinsville, Talladega, the Chicago Street Course. We have the side-by-side action and last lap passes for the win.
Photo finishes. Ryan Blaney will win.
The voice of NASCAR. The Motor Racing Network.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.